Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is John Osborne. It's not too much to say that I wouldn't be an activist or environmental writer without John's guidance. Before I met him, I knew this culture was killing the planet, but I had no idea how to even begin to respond to it. And John channeled my energy, and he taught me many things. John Osborne is a genuinely good and moral person. He's an MD who has dedicated his life to doing what's right, whether it's through his medical work or through his environmental advocacy. He's worked to protect salmon, forests, bull trout, and so many others. He's worked with various indigenous peoples in his region to helping them to protect their land. He's worked on health issues internationally. And most recently, he's begun working on suicide prevention among the young. So, John, can you tell me how you got started, how and why you got started doing the environmental work?
Well, I grew up in the Northwest and just enjoyed rivers and walking through forests, and my mother took me to a wilderness hearing in Sun Valley, Idaho, and eventually I moved to Spokane to do my residency training in internal medicine at the same time that the Idaho congressional delegation and then Senator McClure was undertaking a wilderness bill process. It was 1983, and so I got involved trying to protect a place in the watershed of the Spokane River called the St. Joe in the Clearwater, yeah. Place of great beauty, known as the Mallard Larkins. And so that was, for me, really where a lot of the journey started, was in that advocacy and the events that followed.
And so why do you do it?
Well, to not do the advocacy work would make me feel very uncomfortable. And it's the right thing to do. You know, you see these problems that cry out for attention, and you take steps to address them. You know, whether you're looking at the destruction of forests or massive mine waste pollution or corruption by government and government officials, the need to reform HIV screening within a government agency, and most recently, kind of in the wake of the loss of my nephew by suicide, the need to address suicide problems that are on the rise in so many at-risk populations. So it's just these, you know, these issues that really cry out, you know, and the need to step forward and to try to address those needs, try to fix them.
One of the things that I've always just loved and respected about you is that you have, if you see a problem, you don't simply sit back and complain about it, but instead you start to work on it. And what is it, do you think, what is it about you or your upbringing or your worldview or something that would lead you to do something about what you perceive as problems, as opposed to, and how can we get more people to do that? Because, you know, I've one of the things I've said for a long time is the big distinction is not between those who advocate for militant resistance and those who advocate for non-militant resistance. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so how do we activate? How do we, what can you see in yourself that could help other people to actually start to do something? There's one more thing, which is one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's really great work to be done. I mean, there's certainly there's not a lack of work to be done.
Yeah, the challenges will only accelerate in a time of climate change. I don't know what it, I think there comes a point in the lives of most people when they, they get pushed too far or they become angry. A good friend of ours, Barry Rosenberg, used to talk about it in terms of fire in the belly and, the anger that that he had about the destruction of the national forests here in the region, and it was a drive for him that was compelling. People, get angry and they'll write an email. I always encourage them never to send it until they've kind of calmed down and done the first edit. But I think most people have that energy, and the challenge is to channel it into something that achieves some sort of, some sort of objective, I guess. I would say in medicine, we have, when I'm approaching a patient in the emergency room on a gurney or at the bedside, we have a highly structured approach to problem solving. It's called the history and the physical, the H and P. And, it for me has become a structure for approaching problems just because, I'm not facile intellectually enough to create a whole new problem-solving template when I move from the bedside to the streamside. And so, taking the time to listen, to take the history, listen to your patients, listen to what they're telling you, go out and listen to the land, the title of your book, is really that first step, observe, examine the patient, do the diagnostics, do the scientific analysis, and then, put it together in terms of, a diagnostic list, and from that, create your action items, your list of things to be done, all within an ethical framework. And so when I'm, approaching different problems, that template is extraordinarily useful. You used to have a sign on your wall at your house here in Spokane, about listening. And I think when we, even while we may be angry about the duplicity or the outright corruption among officials or others and the destruction in the wake of that corruption, I think it's important, to take the time to listen and to learn. In the end, it will improve the quality of the decision making that we as individuals make. I don't know, Derek. Is that?
No, it's great. And I'm thinking about something a doctor said to me once that was one of the stupidest things a doctor has ever said to me. And I've thought about this in terms of ridiculous doctoring before, but I haven't really put this particular thing together with forest management or fisheries management until now, which is, as you know, I had most of my colon removed when I was 24 because of Crohn's disease. And maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I went to a doctor because I was having a terrible flare. And one of the things I told him is that I have pain in my lower right quadrant, in the lower right part of my abdomen. And he had taken the history, so he looked at me and he said, "You can't have pain there because you don't have any intestines there." And it cracked me up, because it didn't crack me up at the time because I was appalled, but it's like, okay, what am I supposed to believe? I'm feeling pain here, and I actually know more than you what's going on. And the way this reminds me about fisheries or forest management is that management's part of the problem, is that so often Forest Service officials, TIM industry people, whomever, the capitalist decision makers will so often go in and they'll see a problem, but they're not actually listening to the actual, not listening to the patient. They're not, he wasn't listening to me. Instead, he was projecting his preconceptions onto my actual body. And it's the same thing, that the solution so often by the Forest Service to, well, gosh, if you have a forest that's really healthy, we need to cut it. And if you have a forest that's in, that's having beetle problems, well, then you need to cut it. And if you have a forest that has been overcut, well, you need to cut it. And if you have a problem that is there aren't enough dead trees, then, well, you need to cut the live trees. You have to kill them to make them dead. And so it's not actually, they've never once actually listened, but instead they're simply making more excuses to project what they wanted to do in the first place.
Right. Well, you know, and, taking care of patients, diagnosis is the first step to treatment, and a careful history is the first step to diagnosis, but, and that's true in dealing with environmental issues, but it's interesting that the treatment decision is so often the same, you know, build a dam. Got a problem, build a dam, you know, got an issue in the forest, cut it down. So, yeah, it's depressing and outright enraging at times, but that's, there are drivers, at work, in that. You know, you had talked about how do we help others? And I think, you know, sometimes, just taking the time to work, with others who are struggling. Right now, for example, I was actually asked by a member of the Yakima Nation to come out and look at these massive industrial dairies in the lower Yakima Valley. There's this tremendous pollution of groundwater. And so I do support work for Indian combat veterans with PTSD, and I had the opportunity to talk with a spiritual leader on the closed area of the Yakima Reservation, and he had recently lost his well because it was so polluted from these dairies. And so kind of with that, I went down last October to do what they call the poop tour. And it was really quite an eye-opener and a sinus closer. That there was so much manure in the air from the, you know, they run the manure from the dairies into the lagoons, and then they pump it out through the sprinkler system. So there's all this kind of manure that's being irrigated through the air. So I had, you know, kind of going through that lower Yakima Valley and just the incredible stench and the impact on, you know, my own sinuses and lungs, and then, you know, looking at the school children and talking with the activists there, and I realized, you know, I can help these people. You know, I've been through some of this before. You know, the work that we did, I and others, dealing with kind of the end of the timber frontier and the incredible destruction of forests here. I mean, we're seeing kind of the CAFO corporate agriculture juggernaut at work in the lower Yakima, so some of the themes are recurrent. So, you know, these are rural folks who are desperate, and, you know, we know enough now that, you know, we have tools that we can use to help them. And it really is a, you know, it's a joy. There are a few joys dealing with incredible destruction, but, you know, one of the real joys is to help people who are themselves, who have found themselves in kind of on the front lines, farmers and ranchers, you know, folks that you just wouldn't expect, you know, to kind of be at the forefront of the challenge to corporate agriculture, but they are, because they've been forced into it. They've been forced backs to the wall to try to save what they care about. And for us to be able to help them is a joy. It's a joy.
Well, I think
so. I think, you know, that's, you know, when you talk about, well, how can we help others? I think we can do that. I mean, because we have experiences, we have hopefully wisdoms that come with our work that we could share with others.
Well, I think I would like for you to address something prescriptively to experienced activists, because it really is true what I said in the introduction about how I'm not sure that I would be an activist if it weren't for your help and guidance, because I had this tremendous energy, and the problems are so large, and I didn't know what to do with it, and so I was just writing letters to the editor, or I would attend, you know, demonstrations or whatever, but I didn't know, I didn't have a focus, and the problems are so large, I didn't have a framework into which I could insert myself to actually start doing something that might be on some level effective. And so I don't know precisely what you, I mean, and the point is not you and me and what, you know, you saw in me or what you did, because you've done this for many people, but what advice and prescriptions can you give for current activists? I mean, when I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, I had so many students who would be interested in doing something, and they were in the same position that I was. It was the upset and the rage and the joy and everything else were all sort of inchoate, and I didn't know how to help them focus, and I didn't know how to hook them in. So can you give advice specifically to more experienced activists as to how to be welcoming to and how to encourage those who may know something's wrong but don't know how they can fit into the struggle?
Well, gosh, Derek, that's a tough question. I mean, we don't have activism 101. Maybe we should. You know, maybe we should formalize an educational course to give budding activists the basic tools to carry out their work. You know, maybe we need to have a mentoring program. You know, in medicine, I took 4 years of training in medical school, but then I had 3 years of residency training. So there's a long process, in part, where you are, mentoring with your attending physicians, and maybe that's something we should look at. But there is nothing, there is no formal structure. I mean, sometimes you can volunteer with a nonprofit organization, and maybe you'll learn something that way. That's the hope. So I don't know. It's a great question. I think we probably need to put some focus on that.
Well,
I hate to see people reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, and you know, one of the problems with activists going to an organization, I remember I sent plenty of people to the Public Lands Council. The Lands Council was an organization which you founded and was one of the central environmental organizations, one of the environmental organizations in Spokane. And I would send people there, sometimes students, and often there wouldn't really be things for them to do. So I talked to some of the staff at the Lands Council about that. And the people I talked to said that part of the problem was it takes an investment on the part of the current activist to teach someone what to do, as you invested in me. And the problem was that they didn't know which of the students were just going to show up for one afternoon and which would consistently then show up. And so I understand from both the perspective of the activist to be with, gosh, what do I do? And I understand from the perspective of the current activist who would be the mentor, I don't have time. I'm already pulled in 50 directions, and I don't know that this person's actually going to show up every week. They may just show up once, in which case I've wasted 3 hours teaching them how to do something when they may never show up again.
Right. But on the other hand, you know, we had what became a national model for Forest Watch. We had Barry Rosenberg as our Forest Watch director, and, you know, Barry he had this great set of skills. He was a tree planter, you know, a woodworker, worked in the woods, and so he was pretty savvy, and he also had taught himself how to appeal a timber sale to try to protect his own source of drinking water. He lived in the forest, and his water came from a place that was targeted with a clear cut. And so with that experience and with that wisdom, he became a teacher, and he would move out into the region and teach people how to protect their watersheds, how to challenge the Forest Service. And it worked incredibly well. But that, at least for a while, until, you know, the Forest Service started creating, you know, slicker documents. But, you know, that's a model. And so I suspect what, you know, we need to do is, you know, to look at those models. We have something similar. I'm the board president of a group called the Center for Environmental Law and Policy, which is a hard-edged water protection group in Washington State, and we work on protecting rivers and drinking water aquifers. And we have a water rights 911 program to help support people who are out there on the front lines, you know, who are at risk of losing their wells, or who are, you know, challenging just the corrupt misuse of the public's waters. And so there, you know, we really do, in a way, do what Barry did. We kind of move in with these folks. We help them at the legislature and fight off, you know, the corporate adversaries. And, you know, we work with them in terms of the public arena and the media, and then also help them in the court system, find them, you know, attorneys who are willing to provide pro bono services or, in some cases, represent them directly. So, I mean, that is like Forest Watch and the Water 911 program. I mean, these are programs that are really intended to kind of work with frontline activists who are really struggling. And so that's also a potential model.
Yeah. One of the jokes that I've told at my talks for years is that a lot of my books are really sort of, I'm ghostwriting for John Osborne because you have taught me so much. And one of them, I mean, there are so many lines that have been so important to me. And one of them that you just mentioned a while ago that I want to come back to is diagnosis is the first step toward cure. How is it exactly you say it?
It's the old adage in medicine. Diagnosis is the first step to treatment.
And I see this oftentimes as, I think environmentalists are frankly pretty terrible at making the proper diagnosis, in that so often, it's like Paul Kingsnorth has been saying for years, and I agree with this, that when did environmentalism, I'm not talking about you, I'm not talking about frontline activists at all, I'm talking more about sort of environmental intelligentsia, what I call them, when did environmentalism become not about protecting wild places, but instead about making this capitalist system last longer? So that when did environmentalism become not about actually protecting a river, protecting salmon, but instead about so-called sustainables like renewable energy, which, you know, as we know, is a complete disaster for forest areas where they put in big solar panels, and it's more of the same, really. And so do you want to say more about that? It's okay if you don't. If you want to say more about the diagnosis is a first step toward treatment? Because we oftentimes don't step back. But, you know, when I was 24, the doctors were going to do a surgery that probably would have killed me, and they were actually going to do a surgery for the wrong disease until my mom pulled me out of the hospital. I mean, just literally yanked the stuff out of my arms and drove me to another hospital because she called the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. They said they're killing him. And they had the wrong disease diagnosed and were going to do the completely wrong thing. And that's just on a personal level. Of course, we see it on a larger scale, too. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, when you walk into an intensive care unit, I don't know how many people are listening have ever done that, but, you know, I remember the first time I did as a medical student, and, gosh, you know, it can seem overwhelming. I mean, there's the patient's on a ventilator, and there's a tube in every orifice, and there's all kinds of monitors and beeps, and in order to help this person, I mean, you have to be rigorous, and you have to kind of work systematically through the long list, usually long list of diagnoses. And I mean, if you just focus on one thing, work on the diabetes and make the glucose numbers look better, or, you know, focus on the electrolytes, you know, the patient's not going to make it. I mean, you really do need to look comprehensively at what's going on. And I think I would say, you know, as you kind of move from the bedside, you know, to the stream side, you know, I think you do need to step back and look at what's going on here, because otherwise we're going to lose the patient. And, of course, or you might argue, unfortunately, that, you know, the prognosis is pretty grim here, but you do have to step back and look at what's going on here with climate change and the tremendous destruction looking back, and the accelerating destruction looking forward, and how we can try to hold on to bits and pieces of this. The other thing I wanted to say, Derek, is about ethics and the environmental industry. I have helped to create one nonprofit and you know, served on multiple NGO boards, and I would just say I am, you know, concerned about the ethical underpinnings of the so-called environmental movement, and that, you know, I think, you know, when we create all these staff positions, and, you know, you've got budgets, and you've got, you know, you've got staff needs, and, you know, after a while, you know, the keeping the doors open and keeping the organization afloat can take priority over the mission. And you know, I am concerned about kind of the ethics of what's taking place. As we have kind of moved from, you know, an environmental movement that has been dominated by frontline activists, as we were in the early 1980s in places like Idaho and Eastern Washington, we have transitioned into something very different, which are, you know, in some respects competing nonprofit corporations. We've, you know, pursued this corporate model, and I think often to the detriment of our ability to try to protect places and to protect important public resources. So I do think ethics matter, and ethics is an important contextual feature for the discussion about what's taking place.
Well, that ties into another line that you have said to me that has really informed my work and my life, which is that I remember asking you what you are hoping to accomplish and what you're doing, especially when things look so bad. And what you've said to me is, we can't predict the future. And what you want to do is to make sure that as things become increasingly chaotic, that some doors remain open. And I asked you what you meant by that, and you said that you meant that if bull trout are still around in 20 years, they may still be around in 100, but if they're gone in 20, they're gone forever. And if Selkirk caribou are around in 40 years, they may be around in 100, but if they're gone in 40, they're gone forever. And the same is true with just some patch of forest. If it's still standing in 10 years, it may be cut in 11, or it may still be standing in 100, but if it's cut, then it's been cut. If the dam's been put in, the dam's been put in. And so can you comment on that?
Well, you know, sometimes you can kind of think of it like someone who's like a burn patient. You know, their skin is just so badly damaged, but there are places, you know, where if it's not too badly damaged, you know, there are places where things can start to heal again, sometimes I think about that when I think about what's taking place, across the planet. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Derek, and I know you and I have talked about it, but, you know, sometimes I will kind of transform where I am back, you know, before, you know, Euro-American people, you know, came, you know, so I will be, you know, walking, and then I'll have this kind of image of what this must have or might have looked like, you know, before all of the roads and before all the apartment houses, you know, what it must have been like. And in so many places, I mean, that's just the blink of an eye. I mean, slightly more than 200 years since Lewis and Clark, you know, walked out of the United States and into the Columbia River watershed. And, you know, the world was a place of 16 million wild salmon that came in each year to spawn and renew this great cycle of life. And people that had lived with the river for time immemorial. And, you know, in 200 years, look what has happened. And so if you look back and then look forward, it is very unsettling. And if you care about, you know, if you care about life, if you, you know, you care about so many voices that have no voice in the decisions that are destroying the planet, if you care about the birds and children and children unborn and, you know, on and on, then, you know, if you care about these things, then, I mean, you have to take action. I mean, not to take action would be unacceptable. I mean, how could you live with yourself? And so the question isn't whether or not you take action, it's what actions do you take? So can you stop it? Well, maybe not. Should you try? You bet. Should try every day. I mean, it really becomes an activity of daily living. It just becomes part of your life, because not to do it would be unacceptable. I don't know. I mean, you and I have talked about this before, and
it's pretty much all we've ever talked about.
Changed. They haven't changed over time.
So tell me about your work with the prevention of suicide.
Well, it's really kind of, in some respects, it's just getting underway. And I can say that when I was chief of medicine at the VA, I did bring in a good friend, Paul Quinette. And Derek, I think you know Paul. He's a a writer, active angler, and also is an international leader in suicide prevention and a good friend. And so I brought Paul in to help provide courses, courses at the for our clinical staff. And the reason is because veterans are high risk for suicide. I think, you know, many of the listeners know that. I think helped some of my patients over the years, in getting treatment. And then I have also lost, I know at least one patient that I lost through suicide, and I'm sure others that I don't know about. But then, you know, my life changed this year on September 8th, really September 9th, you know, when I picked up the messages on my phone, and the first one was a police officer, and the second one was from my sister, and my incredibly talented, wonderful nephew, Cam, had ended his life by suicide on the night of September 8th. And so within an hour, I was on the plane to Boise, and I just remember holding my sister. And, you know, that while I had worked on trying to help others, other clinical staff do a better job of suicide prevention, I think in that moment and in the days that followed, I realized that I really had to take action, that we have to do a better job with suicide prevention. And my sister, Debbie, and her husband, Stuart Wilder, they have had the courage to speak out at a time when, I mean, it's so reminiscent of the dark days of the AIDS epidemic. You know, we had patients who were dying from AIDS, and, you know, we didn't talk about it, and people were shunned. And kind of going through this with, you know, deaths from by suicide, it's really so reminiscent of that, and we have to take action. And so, again, you know, the first steps are to listen. And so I'm doing the outreach. I'm listening to those who have much more wisdom and experience than I do. And this is going to be a long journey, but I think an important one. So.
And what are you hearing so far when you listen?
Well, you know, some of it I knew. You know, I do work with tribes, and increasingly so in the work on trying to modernize the Columbia River Treaty. And so I know that suicide rates on reservations and among Indians generally, First Nations in Canada, that this is a significant problem. What is really so new to me is just kind of the at-risk groups, such as teens, and just how vulnerable, you know, they are. I mean, I don't know how your adolescence was, but mine was less than perfect, and so you can only imagine today, you know, with...
I remember my high school valedictorian on the intergraduation speech. One of the things she said was that we would all look back on these days as the best of our lives. And I remember thinking when she said that, oh, if these are the best days of my life, I am in deep, deep trouble. Fortunately, that was not true, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've given talks to high school students before where the whole point of my talk really is I just want to give you one message, which is life gets better. Things are not always going to be this horrible. Anyway, so, no, yes, I think high school is – the teen years were just dreadful, dreadful, dreadful.
Yeah. And so I undertook this work to, you know, really try to, you know, to help those at-risk populations, and to some respect, just as we did with Forest Watch and Water Rights 911, to reach out and to empower those at risk. But, you know, inevitably this kind of work will be different, but some of the themes will be the same. And the impacts on those who survived the suicide, the families, the loved ones, is just so, so profound. And I worry at a time of when there's so much and that's unfolding, and in a time of, you know, unfolding climate change and the accelerating environmental destruction and social disruption, that suicide issues are going to become even, you know, more pressing. And so I think much work remains to be done.
Well, we have about 4 minutes left, and before we sum up, there's another question I want to ask you, and people have asked me this many times, and I have no idea ever how to answer. So I'm going to put you in the same position as people put me in, which is you work with a lot of really difficult and sorrowful issues. How do you survive it? Because I know a lot of people don't want to look because they're afraid that it will kill them, and that's all I can say to them is honestly, it was my avoidance of the issue that hurt more than actually the issue itself. But I think people need help and courage and handholding in order to stare at these terrible, terrible issues. And what advice can you give people about that? I mean, maybe it's just, I'm sorry to ask and answer the question myself, but for me also, part of it is to just say to them, looking at the issue isn't going to kill you. And not looking at it actually may. But how do you do it? How do you do it? And what advice can you give to other people who may need some encouragement to be able to stare at the difficult issues?
I don't know, Derek. The personal peace is priceless. To have, you know, to be at peace with yourself. I mean, you may be raging against the system, but to be at peace with yourself is a joy. And as I said before, I think, you know, to be able to help others, I mean, what a joy. And it is hard. I remember, you know, you and I talked about my work in Africa. You know, the kids would come in with meningitis, and you give them, you know, you do the spinal taps and start the antibiotics, and the next morning, you know, the infant would be sitting on the mother's lap and smiling at you, or not, if they didn't survive the night. And then, you know, I started my work with veterans, and darn it, they didn't quit smoking when I told them to. And, you know, your victories are counted in inches and not miles. So you have to just face the reality that some of these problems are going to take, are chronic because the problems are chronic. So like taking care of hypertension or diabetes or, you know, any number of chronic diseases, when you inflict chronic diseases on a global system, you know, you have to understand that your interventions are going to take time. But I just say, if you care, that's the main thing. You know, if you care, then this journey will give you peace. It may not give you victories that are huge. You may not save the planet, but your failure to take action, will assure the outcome, and I think it will be harder in the end, personally, for you.
So that seems like a great note to end on. Is there anything else you want to add? Anything? Any one last message you'd like to give the listeners?
No, Derek. I just want to thank you, and you know, it's been such a great journey with you, and you know, it's just, and you know, it's one that part of which, you know, we journeyed together, and it's just a treasure.
Well, thank you. It's a treasure working with you too, and knowing you. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening. My guest today has been John Osborne. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you very much.